long time, and Mama had listened, her head bowed, tears running down her cheeks. Mama never went back, but sometimes she would still sift the beads through her slender fingers while the rain spat on the window.
"What good are you?" Sarah screamed again. "Tell me!"
A sailor looked at her oddly as he passed by. Rab didn't come back for 2 days, and when he did, he was so drunk he couldn't remember who she was. She sat cross-legged with her back to the fire, looking at him. He was maudlin, sloppy tears running down his bearded cheeks. Every time he raised the half-empty bottle by its neck, she watched his Adam's apple bob. After a while, he fell over and snored, the rest of the whiskey running through the cracks in the floor. Sarah put the blanket over him and sat beside him.
"It's all right, Rab. I'll take care of you now."
She couldn't do it the way Mama did, but she would find some way. Rain drummed against the window. She put out her tin cans and blocked her mind to everything but the sound of the drops plinking into them, making music in the cold, dull room. She was glad, she told herself, really glad. No one would come knocking at the door. No one would bother them any more. Rab was guilt-ridden in the morning. He cried again.
"I gotta keep my promise to May, else she won't rest in peace."
He held his head in his hands and peered at her with bloodshot, sad eyes.
"What am I gonna do with you, kid? I need a drink. Bad."
He looked in the cupboards and found nothing but a can of beans. He opened them and ate half, leaving the rest for her.
"I'm going out a while and think things through. Gotta talk to a few friends. Maybe they can help."
Sarah lay on the bed and pressed Mama's pillow against her face, comforting herself with the lingering scent of her mother. She waited for Rab to come back. As the hours passed, the trembling started deep inside her. It was cold. Snow was falling. She lit the fire and ate the beans. Shivering, she dragged a blanket from the bed and wrapped herself in it. She sat as close to the grate as she could. The sun was going down, and the silence was like death. Everything slowed inside her, and she thought if she closed her eyes and relaxed, she could stop breathing and die. She tried to concentrate on that, but she heard a man's voice, talking and excited. It was Rab.
"You'll be pleased, I swear. She's a good kid. Looks like May, pretty, real pretty, and smart."
She was relieved when he opened the door. He wasn't drunk, just lightly in his cups, his eyes bright and merry. He was smiling for the first time in weeks.
"Everything's going to be fine now, kid," he said, and brought another man into the shack with him.
The stranger was built like the stevedores on the pier, and his eyes were hard. He looked at her, and she drew back.
"Stand up," Rab said, helping her. "This gent's come to meet you. He works for a man who wants to adopt a little girl."
Sarah didn't know what Rab was talking about, but she knew she didn't like the man who had come with him. He came toward her, and she tried to move behind Rab, but Rab held her in front of him. The stranger cupped her chin and lifted her face, turning it from side to side to study her. When he let go, he took up a handful of her blonde hair and rubbed it between his fingers.
"Nice," he said and smiled. "Real nice. He'll like this one."
Her heart drummed wildly. She looked up at Rab, but he sensed nothing wrong.
"She looks like her mother," Rab said, his voice breaking. "She's thin and dirty."
"We're poor," Rab said piteously. Taking some bills from his pocket, the man peeled off two and handed them to Rab. "Clean her up and get her some decent clothes, then bring her here." He gave him an address and left. Rab whooped.
"Things are looking up for you, kid," he said, grinning. Didn't I promise your mama I'd take good care of you?
He took her hand and walked her quickly to another shack, several blocks away. A woman in a thin wrapper answered his knock. Her curly brown hair fell about her pale shoulders, and she had circles beneath her hazel eyes.
I need your help, Stella.
After he explained all, she frowned and chewed on her lower lip.
You sure about this, Rab? You weren't just drunk, were you? It don't sound right somehow. Didn't he give a name or nothing? I didn't ask him, but I know who he works for. Radley told me. The gent who wants to adopt her is rich as Midas and way up in government.
Then why's he looking on the docks for a daughter?
It don't matter, does it? It's the best chance she's got, and I promised May.
His voice trembled with tears. Stella looked at him sadly.
Don't cry, Rab. I'll fix the kid up real pretty. You go get yourself a drink and come back later. She'll be all ready for you.
He went, and Stella rummaged through her wardrobe until she found something soft and pink.
I'll be right back, she said, and took a bucket to get water.
When she came back, she warmed some in a pot.
Now you wash good. No man wants a dirty girl.
Sarah did what she was told, fear growing in her belly. Stella washed her hair with the rest of the water.
You've the prettiest hair I ever did see. It's just like sunshine, and you've got pretty blue eyes, too.
The woman altered the pink shirtwaist and braided Sarah's hair with blue ribbons. Sarah remembered Mama doing the same thing when they lived at the country cottage. Or had she dreamed that time? Stella put pink paint on Sarah's cold cheeks and lips and rubbed it in gently.
You're so pale. Don't be scared, sweetie. Who'd hurt a pretty little angel like you?
Rab came back the next day, drunk, and no coins jingling in his pocket. His eyes were wide, blank, and full of confused pain.
Hello, kid. I guess this is it, huh?
She hugged him tightly.
Don't send me away, Rab. Keep me with you. You be my father.
Yeah? And what am I going to do with a kid, huh?
He pried her loose and looked down at her with a sad smile.
I got enough problems.
You won't have to do anything. I can take care of myself. I can take care of you.
How you gonna do that? You ain't old enough to do nothing worth money. You gonna steal like me? No. You move in with money pockets and have the good life. Now, come on.
They walked a long time. It was getting dark. Sarah was afraid of the shadows and clung tightly to Rab's hand. They passed saloons filled with loud music and shouting and singing. They went down streets lined with houses, big fancy houses, the likes of which she had never seen before. The lit windows looked like great glowing eyes following her every movement. She didn't belong, and they knew it and wanted her gone. Shivering, Sarah hung close to Rab's side as he asked men directions, showing them the slip of wrinkled paper. Sarah's legs ached and her stomach growled. Rab stopped and looked up at the big house flanked by others that were similar.
Ain't this a grand place? He stared in awe.
No flowers. Stone. Cold. Dark. Sarah was too exhausted to care and sat down on the bottom step, miserable, wishing she were back in the shack by the docks with the smell of the sea drifting in on the tide.
Come on, kid. Couple more steps and you're home, Rab said, pulling her up.
She stared fearfully at the huge brass lion head that was on the door. Rab took the ring that was held in its bared fangs and banged it against the door.
Fancy, he said.
A man in a dark suit opened the door and gave Rab a derisive look over. Rab handed him the paper before he could close the door in his face. The man studied it, then opened the door wide enough for them to enter.
"This way," he said coolly.
Inside it was warm and smelled sweet. A wide room opened before Sarah, and in it lay a glorious flowered carpet on a shining wood floor. Above were sparkling jewel lights. She had never seen anything so fine. Heaven must be something like this, she thought wonderingly. A red-haired woman with dark eyes and a full red mouth came to greet them. She was wearing a beautiful black dress with jet beads winking over her shoulders and full breasts. She looked down at Sarah and frowned slightly. Her eyes flashed at Rab and then met Sarah's again more gently. She bent and extended her hand.
"My name is Sally. What's yours, honey?"
Sarah just looked at her and drew back behind Rab.
"She's shy," Rab said apologetically. "Don't mind her."
Sally straightened and looked at him with hard eyes. "You sure you know what you're doing, mister?"
"Sure I know. This is some place you got here, ma'am. Nothing like the dump we've been living in."
"Up the stairs to your right," Sally said in a dull voice. "First door on the left. Wait there." She reached out before Rab took two steps and stopped him. "Unless you're smart and take my advice. Leave now. Take her home."
"Why would I want to do that?"
"You won't see her again after tonight."
He shrugged. "She ain't mine anyway." "Is he here? The big man, I mean."
"He will be shortly, and you'll keep your mouth shut if you've any sense in your head." Rab headed for the stairs. Sarah wanted to run back out the door, but he had a firm hold on her hand. She looked back and saw the woman in black watching her. She had a pained look on her face. Everything in the upstairs room was big. The mahogany highboy, the red brick fireplace, the teak desk, the brass bed. A white marble washstand stood in the corner, along with a brass towel rack polished so fine it looked like real gold. All the lamps had jeweled tassels, and the drapes on the window were blood red. They were closed tightly, so no one could see in or out.
"Sit over there and rest, kid," Rab said, patting her back and pointing toward a wing chair.
It was exactly like the one Mama used to sit in at the country cottage. Sarah's heart suddenly started to race. Could it be the same one? What if her father had been sorry? What if he had been looking for Mama and her all this time and had found out where she was and what had happened? What if he was sorry about all the awful things he had said and wanted her, after all? Her heart beat faster and faster as hope and dreams built of desperation and fear filled her. Rab went to the table near the window.
"Will you look at this?"
He ran his fingers lovingly over a set of crystal bottles. He took the stopper out of one and sniffed the amber fluid inside.
"Oh, my!"
With a sigh, he brought it to his lips and tipped it. Gulping half of what was inside, he wiped his mouth with the back of his sleeve.
"Closest I'll ever get to heaven."
He took the stopper from another and poured a little into the one from which he had drunk. He held them up to see if they were even again, then put them down carefully and fitted the stoppers in place. He opened the armoire and went through it, tucking something in his pocket. Then he went to the desk and went through it as well, tucking more things into his pockets. Sarah heard faint laughter. Her eyes were heavy, and she rested her head against the wing of the chair. When would her father come? Rab went back to the glass bottles and drank from another one.
"Enjoying my brandy?" came a deep, low voice.
Sarah glanced up in surprise. She stared, her heart sinking. It wasn't her father at all. It was a tall, dark stranger. His eyes glittered, and she thought she had never seen a face so cold, nor so handsome. He was dressed all in black and wore a shiny hat. Rab shoved the stopper back into the crystal decanter and put it back on the silver tray.
"Haven't had anything so fine in a long time," he said.
Sarah noticed how his face paled as the man stared at him with those strange eyes. Rab cleared his throat and shifted. He seemed nervous. The man took off his hat and placed it on the desk. Then he took off his gloves and dropped them into it. Sarah was so fascinated by the man that she failed at first to notice the other man standing just behind him. She blinked in surprise. It was the same man who had come to the docks and looked her over. She pressed back against the chair. The second man was watching Rab, and his eyes reminded her of the rats in the alley behind the shack. She looked at the fine gentleman and found him looking at her with a faint smile. But somehow, that smile didn't make her feel better. It made her inside shiver. Why was he looking at her like that, as though he were hungry and she were something he wanted to eat?
"What's her name?" he asked, without taking his eyes from her.
Rab's mouth opened slightly, and he looked dumbfounded.
"I dunno."
He gave an uneasy, befuddled laugh, clearly drunk.
"What did her mother call her?" the man said dryly. "Darlin', but you can call her whatever you like."
The man gave a short, humorless laugh and dismissed Rab with a contemptuous glance. He studied Sarah carefully. She was scared, so scared she couldn't move when he walked toward her. He smiled again when he stopped, his eyes shining oddly. He took a wad of bills from his pants pocket and removed a gold clip. He counted out several and held them out to Rab without even looking at him. Rab took them eagerly, counting them again before he stuffed them into his pocket.
"Thank you, sir. Oh, my, when old Radley told me it was you looking for a daughter, I couldn't believe the kid's luck. And she ain't had much in her life, I can tell you."
He rattled on, saying the gentleman's name twice, too drunk and too stupid to see the change in the man's face. But Sarah saw. He was furious, but more than that, he looked. Sarah shivered again. She wasn't sure how he looked, but it wasn't good. She glanced at Rab, feeling panic build inside her again. He rambled on, trying to flatter and cajole the man standing before her, not even noticing the subtle signal being passed from the gentleman to the man behind Rab. A scream tore at Sarah's throat, but it didn't come out. It couldn't. Her voice was as frozen in terror as the rest of her. She watched in horror as Rab kept talking. He didn't stop until the black cord was looped around his neck. His eyes bugged. Choking, he clawed at his neck, drawing his own blood with his dirty fingernails. Sarah bolted from her chair and ran to the door. She twisted and pulled at the knob trying to escape, but the door wouldn't open. She heard Rab strangling, his feet kicking and scraping as he struggled. She pounded her fists on the wood and screamed. A hard hand clamped over her mouth and yanked her away from the door. She kicked and bit and fought, and gained absolutely nothing. The man's body was stone, and he caught hold of her arms and held them pinned painfully tight with one hand, while the other clamped harder over her mouth. Rab was silent.
"Carry him out of here," the man holding her said, and she got a glimpse of Rab on the floor, the black cord still around his neck, his face grotesquely distorted.
The man who had come to the shack unloosened the cord and slipped it back into his pocket. Pulling Rab up, he draped him over his shoulder.
"Everyone will think he's drunk. Before you dump him in the river, go through his pockets and bring back whatever he stole from me,"
the cold voice said from above her.
"Yes, sir."
Sarah heard the door open and close. When the man let go of her, she ran to the farthest corner of the room and cowered there. He stood in the middle of the room looking at her for a long time. Then he went to the marble stand and poured water into the porcelain bowl. He wrung out a white cloth and walked toward her. She pressed back as far as she could. He hunkered down and grasped her chin. "You're much too pretty for paint," he said, and began to wash her face. She shuddered violently at his touch. She looked at the place where Rab had lain. The man tipped her chin back.
"I don't think that drunken lout was your father. You don't look anything like him, and there's intelligence in your eyes."
He finished washing the rouge from her cheeks and mouth and tossed the cloth aside.
"Look at me, little one."
When Sarah did, her heart pounded until her whole body shook with terror. He held her face so she couldn't look away.
"As long as you do exactly what I tell you to do, we're going to get along fine."
He smiled faintly and stroked her cheek, his eyes glowing strangely.
"What's your name?"
Sarah couldn't answer. He touched her hair, her throat, her arm.
"It doesn't matter. I think I'm going to call you Angel."
Straightening, he took her hand.
"Come on now, Angel. I have things to teach you."
He lifted her and sat her on the big bed.
"You can call me Duke when you get your tongue back."
He took off his black silk coat.
"Which you will, shortly."
He smiled again as he removed his tie and slowly began to unbutton his shirt. And by morning, Sarah knew that Cleo had told her God's truth about everything. Part 1. Defiance. Chapter 1. From Keats. "But strength alone, though of the muses born, is like a fallen angel, trees uptorn, darkness and worms and shrouds and sepulchres, delight it. For it feeds upon the burrs and thorns of life, forgetting the great end of poesy, that it should be a friend to soothe the cares and lift the thoughts of man." California, 1850. Angel pushed the canvas flap back just enough to look out at the mud street. She shivered in the cold afternoon air that carried with it the stench of disenchantment. Pear a Dice lay in the mother lode of California. It was the worst place she could have imagined, a shanty town of golden dreams built out of rotting sails from abandoned ships, a camp inhabited by outcasts and aristocrats, the displaced and dispossessed, the once pampered and now profane. Canvas-roofed bars and gambling houses lined mean streets ruled by unmasked depravity and greed, loneliness and grand illusions. Paradise was wild jubilation. It wed black despair with fear and the foul taste of failure. Smiling cynically, Angel saw on one corner a man preaching salvation, while on the other his brother, hat in hand, fleeced the godforsaken. Everywhere she looked, there were desperate men, exiled from home and family, seeking escape from the purgatory forged by their own decaying hopes for a future. These same fools called her a Cyprian and sought solace where they were most assured of finding none, from her. They drew lots for her favors, 4 ounces of gold, payable in advance to the Duchess, Madam of the Palace, the tent brothel where she lived. Any comer could have Angel for 1/2 hour. Her own meager percentage would be kept under lock and key and guarded by a woman-hating giant named McGowan. As for the rest, those sad unfortunates who lacked the price to sample her talents, they stood knee-deep in a sea of mud called Main Street, waiting for a chance glimpse of the Angel. And she lived 1 year and a month in this place that was unfit for anything but business. When would it end? How had all her desperate plans brought her here, to this horrible place of dirt and broken dreams?
No more right now, the Duchess was saying, ushering several men away. I know you've been waiting, but Angel's tired, and you want her best, don't you?
Men complained and threatened, pleaded and bargained, but the Duchess knew when Angel had reached the limit of her endurance.
She needs a rest. Come back this evening. Drinks on the house.
Relieved that they were gone, Angel let go of the tent flap and went back to lie on the rumpled bed. She stared bleakly at the canvas ceiling. The Duchess had announced this morning at breakfast that the new building was almost finished and the girls would be moving in tomorrow. Angel was ready to have four walls around her again. At least then the cold night wind would not blow in on her through splits in the rotting sailcloth. She hadn't thought how much four walls meant to her when she paid passage on a barkentine destined for California. Then all she had been thinking was escape. All she had seen was her chance for freedom. The mirage had dissolved soon enough when she reached the gangplank and learned she was one of three women aboard a ship with 120 vigorous young men, all of whom had nothing on their minds but adventure. The two hard-eyed prostitutes set to work right away, but Angel had tried to stay in her cabin. Within a fortnight, she saw clearly that she had one simple choice: go back to being a prostitute or be raped. What did it really matter anyway? What else did she know? She might as well line her pockets with gold like the others. Maybe then, just maybe, with enough money she could buy freedom. She survived the rough seas, the foul-tasting lobscouse and hushamagrundy, the cramped quarters and lack of dignity and decency, in the hope that she would have enough money by the time she reached the shores of California to start a new life. Then, amid the excitement of docking, the final blow was struck. The two other prostitutes set upon her in her cabin. By the time she regained consciousness, they were ashore with all her money and every possession she owned. All that was left to her was the clothes on her back. What was worse, not even one sailor remained aboard to row her ashore. Beaten and numb with confusion, she sat huddled in the bow of the ship for 2 days before scavengers came. When they finished taking what they wanted from the deserted ship and her, they brought her to the dock. It was raining hard, and while they argued and divided their booty, she simply walked away. She wandered for several days, hiding her face and hair beneath a soiled blanket one of the men had given her. She was hungry, she was cold, and she was resigned. Freedom was a dream. She made her way by working Portsmouth Square, until the Duchess, a woman well past her prime but possessed of a shrewd mind for business, found her and talked her into heading for the gold country.
"I've got four other girls, a Frenchie from Paris, a Celestial Ah Toy sold me, and two girls who look like they came off an empty potato boat from Ireland. A little food will fatten them up. Ah, but now you. First time I saw you, I thought there's a girl who can get rich with the right management. A girl with your beauty could make her fortune up there in the gold camps. Those young miners will take the gold out of the stream and fight each other to put it right in your hand."
On an agreement that Angel would turn over 80% of her earnings, the Duchess promised to see that she was protected from bodily harm.
"And I'll see that you have the best clothing, food, and lodgings available."
Angel found the irony laughable. She had fled from Duke and fallen into the hands of Duchess. Just her luck. For all her seeming benevolence, Duchess was a greedy tyrant. Angel knew she collected bribes to fix the lots, while not a speck of that gold dust found its way into the girls' pouches. The tips left for services well rendered were divided according to the original agreement. Mei Ling, Ah Toy's celestial slave girl, tried to hide her gold once, and McGowan, with his cruel smile and ham-sized hands, was sent in to have a talk with her. Angel hated her life. She hated the Duchess, she hated McGowan, she hated her own wretched helplessness. Most of all, she hated the men for their relentless quest for pleasure. She gave them her body, but not a particle more. Maybe there wasn't any more. She didn't know, and that didn't seem to matter to any of the men. All they saw was her beauty, a flawless veil wrapped around a frozen heart, and they were enthralled. They looked into her angel eyes and were lost. She was not fooled by their endless declarations of love. They wanted her in the same way they wanted the gold in the streams. They lusted for her. They fought for the chance to be with her. They scrambled, grappled, gambled, and grabbed, and everything they had was spent without thought or consideration. They paid to become enslaved. She gave them what they thought was heaven and consigned them to hell. What did it matter? She had nothing left. She didn't care. An even stronger force than the hatred that feasted on her was the weariness that sucked her soul dry. At 18, she was tired of living and resigned to the fact that nothing would ever change. She wondered why she had even been born. For this, she supposed. Take it or leave it. God's truth. And the only way to leave it was to kill herself. Every time she faced that fact, every time she had the chance, her courage failed. Her only friend was a tired old harlot named Lucky, who was running to fat because of her thirst for brandy. Yet even Lucky knew nothing of where Angel had come from, or been, or what had happened to make her the way she was. The other prostitutes thought of her as invulnerable. They all wondered about her, but they never asked questions. Angel made it clearly understood from the beginning that the past was sacred ground no one walked over. Except for Lucky. Dumb, drunk Lucky, for whom Angel held a fondness. Lucky spent her off time deep in her cups.
You gotta have plans, Angel. You gotta hope for something in this world.
Hope for what?
You can't get by any other way. I get by just fine.
How?
I don't look back, and I don't look forward.
What about now? You gotta think about now, Angel.
Angel smiled faintly and brushed her long golden hair.
Now doesn't exist.
Chapter 2. From Byron. She walks in beauty, like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes.
Michael Hosea was unloading crates of vegetables from the back of his buckboard when he saw a beautiful young woman walking along the street. She was dressed in black, like a widow, and a big, rough-looking man with a gun on his hip was at her side. All along Main Street, men stopped what they were doing, took off their hats, and watched her. She said not a word to anyone. She looked neither to the right nor the left. She moved with simple, fluid grace, her shoulders straight, her head held high. Michael couldn't take his eyes off her. His heart beat faster and faster as she came near. He willed her to look at him, but she didn't. He let out his breath after she passed him, not even aware that he had been holding it. This one, beloved. Michael felt a rush of adrenaline mingled with joy.
Lord. Lord.
Something, ain't she? Joseph Hochschild said.
The burly storekeeper held a sack of potatoes over his shoulder and grinned.
That's Angel, prettiest girl west of the Rockies and most likely prettiest east of the Rockies, too.
He went up the steps into his store. Michael shouldered a barrel of apples.
What do you know about her?
No more than anyone else, I guess. She takes long walks. It's a habit of hers. Does it every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoon about this same time.
He nodded toward the men along the street.
They all come to watch her.
Who's the man with her?
A dismal thought occurred to him. Her husband? Husband? He laughed. More like a bodyguard. His name's McGowan. He makes certain nobody bothers her. No one gets within a foot of her unless they've paid their dues.
Michael frowned slightly and went back outside. He stood at the back of his wagon, staring after her. She caught at something deep inside him. There was a grave, tragic dignity about her. As the storekeeper hefted another crate, Michael asked the question burning inside him. "How do I meet her, Joseph?" Hochschild smiled ruefully.
"You have to get in line. The Duchess holds a regular lottery to see who'll have the privilege of seeing Angel."
"What Duchess?"
"The Duchess down there."
He nodded down the street in the other direction. "The one who owns the palace, the biggest brothel in paradise." Michael felt as though he had been kicked, low and hard. He stared at Hochschild, but the man didn't even notice as he toted a crate of carrots inside and upended it into a bin. Michael shouldered another barrel of apples.
"Lord? Did I misunderstand? I must have. This can't be the one."
"I put up the ounce of gold a time or two to get my name in a hat," Joseph said over his shoulder. "That was before I found out it took more than that just to get your name in the right hat."
Michael banged the barrel down hard. "She's a soiled dove? A girl like that?" He didn't want to believe it.
"She's not just any old soiled dove, Michael. Angel is something real fine from what I hear. Special training. But I can't afford to find out for myself. When I've a need, I see Pris. She's clean, does things plain and simple, and she doesn't cost too much hard-earned gold."
Michael needed some air. He went back outside. Unable to help himself, he glanced down the street again at the slender girl in black. She was coming back down the other side of the street and went right past him again. His reaction was worse this time, harder to take. Hochschild unloaded a crate of turnips.
"You look like a bull who just had a club put to his head." His smile was wry. "Or maybe you've been down on your farm too long."
"Let's settle up," Michael said tersely, and went inside with the last crate. He needed to get his mind back on business and off of her.
"You'll have enough gold to meet her once we square up," Hochschild said. "More than enough."
He emptied the crate and set it aside before putting his scale on the counter.
"Fresh vegetables are worth a fortune up here. These young gents get up on the streams and live on little better than flour, water, and salted meat. Then they come into town with swollen, bleeding gums and swelling legs from scurvy and think they need a doctor. All they need is a decent diet and a little common sense. Let's see what we got here. 2 barrels of apples, 2 crates each of turnips and carrots, 6 crates of squash, and 20 pounds of venison jerky."
Michael told him what he wanted for the wagon load.
"What? You're robbing me."
Michael smiled slightly. He wasn't green. He had spent the better part of 48 and 49 panning gold and knew what the men needed. True, food was only part of it, but it was a part he could supply.
"You'll make twice that."
Hochschild opened the safe behind the counter and took out 2 sacks of gold dust. He slid one across to Michael and measured a portion out of the other into a hide pouch. Tossing the bigger sack back into the safe, he kicked it shut and checked the handle. Michael emptied the dust into a belt he had crafted. Hochschild watched, his mouth tipping.
"You got enough for a good time there. Want to meet Angel? You ought to go down and talk to the Duchess with some of it. She'll usher you right upstairs."
Angel. Just her name affected him.
"Not this time."
Joseph saw the set of his jaw and nodded. Michael Hosea was a quiet man, but there wasn't anything soft about him. There was something in his look that made men treat him with respect. It wasn't just his height or the strength of his body, which were both impressive enough. It was the clear steadiness of his gaze. He knew what he was about, even if the rest of the world didn't. Joseph liked him, and he had seen clearly enough the effect Angel had on him, but if Michael didn't want to discuss it, he would respect that.
"What are you planning to do with all that gold dust?" I'm going to buy a couple head of cattle.
Good, Hawkshield said in approval. Breed 'em fast. Beef is worth more than vegetables.
On his way out of town, Michael drove by the brothel. It was big and fancy. The place was overflowing with men, mostly young, some bewhiskered and some smooth-cheeked, nearly all drunk or well on their way to being so. Someone was fiddling, and men were making up bawdy verses to the tune, each cruder than the last. And she lives there, he thought, up in one of those rooms with a bed and little else. He flicked the reins over his horses and kept on going, frowning heavily. He couldn't get his mind off her, not all the rest of that day, back down out of the mother lode to his valley. He kept seeing her walking up that muddy street, a slender girl, dressed in black, with a beautiful pale face of stone. Where had she come from? Angel, he said, trying her name on his tongue. Just testing. And he knew, even as he said it, his waiting was over. Lord, he said heavily. Lord, this isn't exactly what I had in mind, but he knew he was going to marry that girl anyway.
Chapter 3. From William Walsh. I can endure my own despair, but not another's hope. Angel washed, put on a clean blue silk wrapper, and sat on the foot of the bed to wait for the next knock on her door. Two more and she could call it a night. She could hear Lucky's laughter in the next room. Lucky was full of laughter and fun when she was drunk, which was most of the time. The woman could lose herself in a bottle of whiskey. Angel had tried drinking with her once to see if she could lose herself too. Lucky poured, and she tried to keep up. Before long her head swam and her stomach lurched. Lucky held the chamber pot for her and laughed with sympathy. She said some people could hold their whiskey, and some couldn't, and she guessed Angel was one who couldn't. She took her back to her room and told her to sleep. That night, when the first man had come knocking at the door, Angel told him in less than polite terms to go away. Angry, he went to the Duchess and said he wanted his gold dust back. Duchess came up, took one look at Angel, then sent for McGowan. Angel didn't like McGowan, but she had never been afraid of him. He had never bothered her. He was just there at her side when she went for her walks. He didn't say anything. He didn't do anything. He just made sure no one approached her outside the palace. She knew it wasn't as much for her own protection as it was for the Duchess. He was there to make sure she came back. Mei Ling never said what McGowan did to her when he had been sent to her room. But Angel saw the look of fear in the Chinese girl's dark eyes every time he was near. All he had to do was smile at her, and the girl turned white and broke out in a sweat. Angel sneered inwardly. It would take more than words to make her afraid of any man. That night, when McGowan came in, Angel was only aware of a dark shape standing over her. "You're not going to get your money's worth," she said. She focused. "Oh, it's you. Go away. I'm not going for a walk today." He ordered her tub filled. As soon as the two servants left, he bent over her again, grinning viciously. "I knew sooner or later we'd have to have a little talk." He caught hold of her. Sobering, she struggled, but he lifted her and dumped her into the icy water. Gasping, she tried to get out, but he grabbed her head and forced her under. Terrified by the iron weight of his huge hand, she fought. When her lungs burned for air and she was losing consciousness, he dragged her up. "Enough," he said. "Enough," she rasped, dragging in air. He shoved her down again. She bucked and kicked, clawing for escape. When he pulled her up again, she choked and vomited. He laughed, and she knew he was enjoying it. He stood in front of her, feet planted apart, and reached for her head again. An irrational fury rose, and she swung her fist straight and sure. When he dropped to his knees, groaning, she scrambled out of his reach. When he came after her again, she screamed. He caught hold of her. She kicked and scratched, gasping with effort. He had a hand at her throat when the door burst open and the Duchess sailed in. She slammed the door behind her and shouted at both of them to stop it. McGowan did as she commanded, but he gave Angel a malevolent look.
"I'm going to kill you. I swear it."
"Enough," the Duchess said, furious. "I heard her scream from the stairway. If the men heard, what do you think would happen?"
"They'd hang him," Angel said, crossing her legs and laughing at him.
The Duchess slapped her. Angel fell back in shock. "Not another word, Angel," the Duchess warned. Straightening, she looked at McGowan again. "I said sober her up, Brett, and have a talk with her. That's all I wanted you to do to her. Do you understand?" She yanked on the bell cord. The three waited in pulsating silence. The slap had silenced Angel. She knew Duchess had barely reined in her devil. She also knew after one look at him that another foolish outburst on her part might snap his leash. When someone knocked discreetly, Duchess opened the door enough to order hot coffee and bread. When she closed the door, she crossed the room and sat down on the straight-backed chair.
"I sent you to do something very simple, Brett. You do just what I tell you and nothing more," she said. "Angel's right. They'd hang you."
"She needs a good lesson," McGowan said, eyes black on Angel. All her bravado had evaporated. She'd seen clearly enough that something dark and evil shone in McGowan's eyes. She recognized that look. She had seen it on another man's face from time to time. She had never taken Brett seriously before, but he was serious indeed. She also knew that fear was the very last thing she could show. It would feed his bloodlust until even the Duchess couldn't stop him. So she was calm and still, like a mouse in its hole. The Duchess looked at her for a long moment.
"You're going to behave now, aren't you, Angel?"
Angel sat up slowly and looked back at her with grave, sardonic eyes.
"Yes, ma'am."
She shivered with cold.
"Give her a sheet before she catches a chill."
McGowan snatched one from the bed and flung it at her. She wrapped the satin around herself like a royal robe and didn't dare look at him. Helpless rage and fear feasted on her.
"Come here, Angel," the Duchess said.
Angel raised her head and looked at her. When she didn't move quickly enough, McGowan grabbed a handful of blonde hair and yanked her up. She gritted her teeth, refusing him the satisfaction of crying out.
"When she tells you to do something, you do it," he snarled as he shoved her.
Angel fell to her knees before Duchess. The woman stroked her hair, and the calculated gentleness after McGowan's brutality destroyed Angel's defiance.
"When the tray arrives, Angel, eat the bread and drink every last drop of the coffee. Brett will stay to see that you do. As soon as you're finished, he'll leave. I want you ready to work in 2 hours."
The Duchess stood and went to the door. She glanced back.
"Brett, not another mark on her. She's our best girl."
"Not a mark," he echoed coldly.
He kept his word. He didn't touch her, but he talked, and what he said chilled Angel's blood. She forced the bread and coffee down, knowing the sooner she was done, the sooner he would leave.
"You're going to be mine, Angel. In a week or a month, you'll push Duchess too far and demand too much, and then she'll give you to me on a silver plate."
She had been good since that evening, and McGowan had not bothered her. But he was waiting, and she knew it. She refused to give him the satisfaction Mei Ling did. She always smiled at him mockingly when he came into the room. As long as she did what she was told, Duchess was happy, and Brett McGowan could do nothing. But the walls were closing in again. More each day. The pressure inside her was building, and the effort to maintain the calm facade was draining her strength.
"One more tonight, and I can sleep," she thought.
She held out her hands and looked at them. They were trembling. She was trembling all over. She knew she was losing control, too much pretending for too long. She shook her head. All she needed was a good night's sleep, and she would be all right tomorrow. "Just one more," she thought, and hoped he'd be quick. The knock came, and she rose to answer. Opening the door, she took in the man standing there. He was taller and older than most, and well-muscled. Other than that, she noticed nothing special about him. But she felt, what? An odd uneasiness, an increasing in her shakiness. Her nerves were jumping almost out of control. She lowered her head and breathed slowly, pushing the strange reaction down with every ounce of will she had left. One more, and I'm free for the night. Despite his 26 years, Michael felt like a callow youth, standing outside Angel's open door in the dim lantern light of the brothel hallway. He could scarcely breathe, his heart was racing so fast. She was even more beautiful than he remembered, and smaller. Her slender body was clearly outlined in the blue satin wrapper, and he tried not to look below her shoulders. She stepped aside so he could enter her room. All Michael saw was her bed. It was made, but visions came to him unbidden, and unnerved he looked back at her. She smiled slightly. It was a worldly, seductive smile. She knew everything that was in his mind, even what he didn't want there. "What's your pleasure, mister?" Her voice was low and soft, and surprisingly cultured, but she was so direct he was taken aback. She couldn't have said anything to make him more acutely aware of what she did for her living, or of his own powerful physical attraction to her. As he entered the room, Angel closed the door behind him and leaned back against it. She waited for him to answer while making a quick assessment of him. Her uneasiness lessened. He wasn't so different from the rest. Just a little older than most, a little broader in the shoulders. He was no boy, but he looked uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. Maybe he had a wife somewhere and was feeling guilty. Maybe he had a good Christian mother and was wondering what she would think about his coming to a prostitute. This one wouldn't want to spend a lot of time with her. Good. The less time, the better. Michael didn't know what to say. He had been thinking about seeing her all day, and now that he was here in her bedroom, he stood mute, his heart beating its way up into his throat. She was so beautiful, and she looked amused. Lord, what now? I can't even think past what I'm feeling. She walked toward him, every movement drawing his attention to her body. Angel touched his chest and heard him suck in his breath. She moved around him, smiling. No need to be shy with me, mister. Tell me what you want. He looked down at her. You. I'm all yours. Michael watched her cross the room to a washstand. Angel. The name fit the way she looked, a flawless blue-eyed porcelain doll with pale skin and golden hair. Maybe marble was a better description. Porcelain shatters. She looked too hard for that. So hard he hurt looking at her. Why? He hadn't expected to feel that. He had worried too much about getting past the desire he knew she would arouse in him. God, give me strength to resist her temptation. She poured water into a porcelain bowl and picked up a bar of soap. Everything she did was graceful and provocative. Why don't you come here and I'll wash you? He could feel the heat rushing all through his body, most of it ending up in his face. He coughed and felt as though his collar were choking him. She laughed softly. I promise it won't hurt. It's not necessary, ma'am. I'm not here for sex. No, you're here for Bible study. I came here to talk with you. Angel gritted her teeth. Hiding her irritation, she let her gaze drift boldly. He moved uneasily beneath that look. She smiled. Are you sure you want to talk? I'm sure. He looked dead certain. With a sigh, she turned to dry her hands. Whatever you want, mister. She sat on the bed and crossed her legs. Michael knew what she was doing. He fought the swift desire to take her up on the clear message she was sending him. The longer he stood silent, the more his mind drew images. and she knew it by the look in her eyes. Was she mocking him? No doubt about that.
Do you live in this room when you're not working?
Yes, she tilted her head. Where did you think I lived? In a little white cottage at the end of a road somewhere? She smiled to take the bite from her words. She hated men who asked questions and probed. Michael studied her surroundings. No personal articles out, no pictures on the wall, no knick-knacks on the small lace-covered table in the corner, no feminine clothing scattered about. Everything was neat, clean, spare. A modest armoire, a side table, a kerosene lamp, a marble washstand with a yellow porcelain water pitcher, and a straight-backed chair furnished her room, and the bed on which she was sitting. He got the chair from the corner, set it in front of her, and sat down. Her satin wrap had opened a little. He knew she was toying with him. She swung her foot idly, like a pendulum, 60 seconds to a minute, 30 minutes to a half hour. All the time he had. Lord, I'd need a million years to reach this woman. Are you sure this is the one you meant for me? Her eyes were blue and fathomless. He could read nothing in them. She was a wall, an endless ocean, a clouded night sky so dark he couldn't see his hand before his face. He saw only what she wanted him to see.
You said you wanted to talk, mister. So talk.
Michael was saddened. I shouldn't have come to you like this. I should have found another way.
What other way is there?
How was he going to make her understand he was different from the other men who came to her when he came by the same way they did? Gold. He had listened to Joseph and gone to the Duchess, and then he had listened to that woman say Angel was a commodity. A fine, precious, well-guarded commodity. Pay first, then talk. Paying had seemed the easiest, most direct way. He hadn't cared about the price. Now it was clear the easiest way wasn't the best. He should have found another way, another place. She was too ready to work, and not the least bit ready to listen. And he was finding himself too easily distracted.
How old are you?
She smiled slightly.
Old? Real old.
He figured that was right. She wasn't talking about years. He doubted much could surprise her. She looked prepared for anything. Yet he sensed something else about her as well, the same way he had the first time he had seen her. There was another layer beneath the one she was showing now. Lord, how do I get to it?
How old are you?
She asked, turning his question back on him. 26.
Old for a gold miner. Most are 18 or 19. I haven't seen many real men lately.
Her lack of subtlety put him on firmer ground.
Why the name Angel? Because of how you look? Or is that your real name?
Her mouth tightened slightly. The only thing she had left was her name, and she had never told anyone what it was, not even Duke. The only person who had ever called her by her name was Mama, and Mama was dead.
Call me whatever you want, mister. It doesn't matter.
Just because he didn't want what he paid for, that didn't mean she was going to give him anything else. He studied her.
I think Mara suits you.
Someone you knew back home?
No.
It means bitter. She looked at him then, and went very still. What game was this?
Is that what you think?
She lifted one shoulder indolently.
Well, I suppose Mara is as good a name as any.
She began to swing her foot back and forth again, ticking off the time. How long had he been here? How long did she have to put up with him? He kept on.
Where are you from?
Here and there. He smiled slightly at her polite and sultry reticence.
Any here and there in particular?
Just here and there, she said. Her foot stopped and she leaned forward. What about you, mister? What's your name? You from any place in particular? Do you have a wife somewhere?
Are you afraid to do what you really want? She was leveling all barrels at him, but rather than be taken aback, he felt himself relaxing. This girl was more real to him than the one who had greeted him at the door. Michael Hosea, he said. I live in the valley southwest of here, and I'm not married, but I will be soon. She frowned uneasily. It was the way he was looking at her. The intensity unnerved her. What sort of name is Hosea? His smile became wry. Prophetic. Was he making a joke at her expense? Are you going to tell me my future? You're going to marry me, and I'm going to take you out of here. She laughed. Well, my third proposal today, I'm so flattered. Shaking her head, she leaned forward again, her smile cold and cynical. Did he think this was a new approach? Did he think it was necessary? When would you like me to start playing my part, mister? After the rings on your finger. Right now I want to get to know you a little better. She hated him for dragging the game on. The wasted time, the hypocrisy, the endless lies. It had been a long night, and she was in no mood to humor him. What's to tell? What I do is what I am. All it comes down to is you telling me how you want me to be. But be quick. Your time's almost up. Michael saw he had made a fine mess of this first meeting. What had he expected? To come in here, talk plain, and walk out with her on his arm? She looked like she wanted to give him the boot. He was angry at himself for being such a naive fool. You're not talking love, Mara, and I didn't come here to use you. The steady deepness of his words and that name, Mara, roused her anger even more. No? She tilted her chin. Well, I think I understand. She stood. He was sitting, and she moved close, her soft hands combing into his hair. She could feel his tension and relished it. Let me guess, mister. You want to get to know me. You want to find out how I think and what I feel. And most of all, you want to know how a nice girl like me got into a business like this. Michael closed his eyes and clenched his teeth, trying to close out the effect her touch was having on him. Do what you're thinking about doing, mister. Michael put her firmly away from him. I came to talk with you. She studied him through narrowed eyes, and then yanked her wrapper closed and tied the satin ribbons. She still felt exposed beneath his scrutiny. You came to the wrong girl. You want to know what you can have? I'll tell you. And she did, explicitly. He didn't blush this time. He didn't even react. I want to know you, not what you can do, he said roughly. If you want conversation, go down to the bar. He stood. Come away with me and be my wife. She gave a harsh laugh. If you want a wife, send for one by mail, or wait for the next wagon train to cross the mountains. He came toward her. I can give you a good life. I don't care how you got here or where you've been before. Come with me now. She smiled derisively. For what? More of the same? Look, I've heard it all before from 100 others. You saw me and fell in love, and now you can't live without me. You can give me a wonderful life. What a crock. I can. It all comes down to the same thing. No, it doesn't. From my point, it does. A half hour is more than enough time for anyone to own me, mister. You're telling me this is the life you want? What did want have to do with anything? This is my life. It doesn't have to be. If you had a choice, what would you want? From you? Nothing. From living. A bleakness settled inside her. Living? What was he talking about? She felt battered by his questions, and defended herself with an aloof, cool smile. Spreading her hands, she showed off her simple room with its spare furnishings. I have everything I need right here. You've got a roof, food, and fine clothes. And work, she said tightly. Oh, don't you forget my work. I'm real good at it. You hate it,